we think of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we often forget that he was a preacher. He said so many times that he just wanted to be a great pastor, and he ended up being a pastor to the world during his lifetime, and he's still pastoring us during this time. And so we would certainly have speaking with us today a preacher. In fact, he's one of the greatest preachers in our time. Both Time Magazine and CNN called him America's best preacher. I'm speaking of none other than Bishop T.D. Jakes. We're honored to have this pastor and this preacher, Bishop T.D. Jakes. He's a charismatic leader, a visionary, provocative thinker, best-selling author, filmmaker, and entrepreneur who serves as senior pastor of the Potter's House, a global humanitarian organization and 30,000 plus members strong that is located in Dallas, Texas. Many of you know him from Woman, Thou Art Loose, Megafest, and the International Pastors and Leaderships. But most of us know him as a profound preacher who rightly divides the word of truth. We are honored and blessed to have this man of God speak to us in this hour what thus saith the Lord.
I want to take this time to thank the King Center for the tremendous honor of being invited to participate on this momentous occasion, and to Dr. Bernice King in particular. I'm deeply honored to lend my voice along with the myriad of people who have gathered their expertise, their experience, their academia, and their life skills to interject ideas of where we can go from here and to support the overall theme of the beloved community. Dr. King talks about the beloved community because he understands how important it is that we see ourselves as a beloved community. And in spite of the fact that we are a beloved community, we have issues in that community, like you have issues in a family, like you have issues in a company or a business. But that does not negate the fact that we are committed one toward another. His understanding of the beloved community is what we want to talk to you about it today. My thoughts are along the themes of not one of us, but all of us. And when I begin to meditate over what I would say to this auspicious viewing audience, my mind went back and reflected on 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 29, when David has meandered down to the battlefield to bring lunch to his brethren who are engaged in a battle. David, the shepherd boy who has no experience in taking on fights, once he is confronted with the mammoth opposition of Goliath standing in front of him, becomes so compelled and so convicted by the challenges that besought his community that he decided to take on the fight that others had already been fighting in. And he says in that particular verse, "What have I now done? Is there not a cause?" David is saying that it was not his career-mindedness that drove him. He was cause-driven. By profession, up until this point, he had been a shepherd boy. But then he had gone from being a shepherd boy and used the expertise and experience of being a common fellow, a young boy on the outskirts of the community, somebody who had not been revered or respected, but yet challenged by a call and determined to respond to a cause. He makes a decision not because he's interested in a career, but because he understands the magnitude of the challenge that is set before him today. The shepherd boy that killed the first giant later learned that it would take a coalition to kill the rest of the giants. And when I think of that, I think of Dr. King. And I think of Jesus Christ, for example, who understood that he did so many things over the course of his life. But in order to take it to the next level, he had to impart the embodiment of what was in him into the 12 disciples and ultimately into the church. In the same way, we must understand, my brothers and sisters, amidst the many, many years of people asking, who is the next MLK? I would suggest to you that there will probably never, ever be another Dr. Martin Luther King. There will likely never be a voice that penetrates and pierces the darkness of racism and division, of hatred and malice and envy and strife, with as much finesse and technique as he used during that time. We must understand, however, that the cause does not stop with the end of the man, but it multiplies as it did with David down to the next dimension, where we begin to understand that it is not one of us, but it is in fact all of us that are called to respond to face the challenges of our time with the same ferocity and the same intensity and the same fervency of spirit. We must continue on, not as though we had cloned him and not as though we might imitate him, but each to his own position, that we might posture ourselves to understand that collectively we embody the vision, the ideals, the goals, and yes, even the adversity that is associated with the dreamer who dared to have such a dream against such great opposing ideologies. When we think about the beloved community, we are drawn immediately to the word community, which causes our eye to fall to the word unity. In order to have a strong community, we must have a strong semblance of unity. I'm not sure that we will ever see the emergence of one individual who can embody the full breadth and depth of the initiation that was set by Dr. King. But the breadth of his wisdom, coupled with the intellect and charisma, is not manufactured by the whims of men. It is rather by the mandate of God and purpose. And as David would say, it is controlled by the cause. The slogan has been said that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. That is to say, when the challenge comes up, the designated individuals will come forth at that particular time to respond to the opposition that is before us. Now, opposition is a strange thing. We would like to think that opposition is always fair, that it is co-equal, that a heavyweight doesn't fight a lightweight, that a lightweight doesn't fight a heavyweight. But David reminds us that we serve a God who will call us to do things where the odds seem insurmountable, where the challenges seem daunting, where the people we seek to persuade seem deafened to our cry and our petition. And yet we must have a commitment down in the innermost parts and recesses of our souls to rise to the challenge that is set before us. It was the roaring of the giant that instigated the action of David. With no background in killing giants and no background in swords and shields, he still took on the challenge with the little that he had, understanding that he could get the job done because God was with him. And because if God is for us, who then can be against us? I want you to understand today that this is no small challenge today. We've had periods of great accomplishment. We cannot negate that. We've come a long ways from where we started from. I grew up with colored water fountains and the extra bathroom. I remember vividly my father going to the back door of restaurants to get food that we could only eat in the car. I remember vividly back in the 60s having to travel at night, trying to avoid being noticed so that we could move from the hills of West Virginia to the red clay of Alabama without being stopped, without being harassed, without being challenged. And I would love to be able to say that those days are gone. And there have been periods and moments along the way that we had to celebrate that they are certainly much, much, much better than they were when I was a child. But the recent headlines that are so pervasive in our times today remind us that the giant is not dead. He may have been asleep, but he is not gone. The giants that confront us today seem almost as large as the giants that confronted Dr. King. But the bigger they come, the harder they fall. There are many giants that stalk our beloved community, that threaten our unity, that threaten the integrity of our unity and semblance of corrosiveness seems to be so pervasive in our times that even young people are not exempt from feeling the threat that they too can be enlisted into a war that they didn't even ask to be in, but we find ourselves in. We find ourselves drafted into a conflict that we did not pick for ourselves. But as David so eloquently said, is there not a cause? While most and many are going to school seeking a career, there are some amongst us that seek a cause that distracts us from the focus of our ambition, our own career. And even those who are ambitious often have to lay their ambition aside and respond to the daunting, taunting, flaunting parade of the giants that parade themselves against us in this hour, in this time, assuming that they would prevail against us. But if we stand united and if we stand together and if we stand connected and if we stand committed, we can get things together. We can get things done and we can get things moving and we can get things paramount that we could not do on our own. Dr. King asked a question in one of his books, where do we go from here? That is to say, he had done those things that he was sent to do. He had accomplished those challenges that were before him. But he understood that the job was not finished with one person alone. It is not one of us. It will take all of us. And once we settle in on the fact in the next generation, like David, that he cannot do it alone, that we all have a responsibility collectively to become involved in some aspect of bringing about a change that causes our community to be more beloved. It seems audacious to make a statement about a beloved community in the midst of the violence that we see, in the midst of Ahmaud Arbery, in the midst of so many pervasive images before us, in the midst of George Floyd. It seems kind of odd to talk about a beloved community. The community doesn't seem so beloved right now with the gailing on the White House and the tauntings and the killings and the murders and the burnings and the riots. It does not seem like a beloved community. But like most families facing a challenge, if we keep on working, we will work until we work it out. One of the giants that I see before us when you talk about where do we go from here, one of the giants that's facing us is home ownership. A recent article in the Washington Post said in the first quarter of 2020, 44% of black families own their homes compared with 73%, 73.7 to be exact, of white families, according to the Census Bureau. So we're lagging way behind when it comes to home ownership. We're not asking to own a home so that we can be flamboyant, impressive, or keep up with the Joneses. We understand that the acquisition of wealth begins with home ownership. We understand that many of us can't go forward because we're house poor. We understand that many of us have been paying rent for years and unable to move to the height that we hope to go to because we are shackled down with something that gains no equity and moves us no closer to where we're trying to go. The gap, though, is wider in some cities, with just 25% of black families owning a home, say, for example, in places like Minneapolis, compared with 76% of whites, which is the widest gap in the United States cities, with more than 1 million residents, a study of the Redfin real estate brokerage has found. These issues are daunting before us because whereas I would like to be talking about owning your own business, I have to digress and talk about owning your own house because you can't own your own business until you learn how to own your own house. We've got a lot of work to do if we're going to see the change that we need. If we're going to be able to raise our children in places that they can really call their own, if we're going to be able to gather and garner the strength to be able to send them to the schools that they need to go to receive the training that they need to get. And most importantly, to just be in an environment where they can be safe and secure, then we must bring down the giant that taunts us, that says it is possible in America for a white child to grow up in a home that his mother and father owns, but it is much more difficult for a black child to be able to achieve that lofty goal. In reality, that is a giant that we've got to bring down. Not one of us, but all of us. Not one person marching down the street with a bullhorn, but all of us, not necessarily even with a bullhorn, but in the boardrooms, in the courtrooms, in the council, in the banking industry, we have got to challenge the acquisition of wealth gathering, because most of what we're facing today, most of the tasks that we're facing today, is a result of not having the equity that we need in order to move forward in the way that we ought to be able to move forward. When you start talking about giants, I brought up homes first, because you've got to have peace in your home if you don't have it anywhere else. You've got to have solidarity in your house if you don't have it anywhere else. But don't get me wrong and don't get this twisted. Home ownership is not the only giant that we face in 2021. The reality is one of the other giants that's confronting us today is mental health. Recent studies have discussed that the DNA of the grandchildren of the Holocaust survivors were affected in such a way that their grandchildren's DNA had been rearranged and altered by the trauma of their grandparents. While a lot of research was done about Holocaust survivors, little was done with the descendants of slaves. But the trauma is still the same. When you start talking about mental health, you cannot ignore what the last 4 years and the last year in particular has done to the African American community. How can we not be traumatized when the giant has come in and snatched 375,000 dead from COVID-19, disproportionately affecting black and brown families in America? It is not just for the 375,000 that we mourn, but it is for their sons and for their daughters and wives and husbands. And I myself, my phone has been ringing off the hook with people weeping because they could not say goodbye to their mother or their father, or they couldn't be with their loved one at a time of crisis. Parked in parking lots and hospitals, FaceTiming people as they left this world. The collateral damage over the time that we live in is insurmountable. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that we alone have this pain any differently than our white counterparts, but we are far less likely to get the help that we need than our white counterparts. If you are not mentally healthy, then it does you no good to be physically healthy. We need strong minds to fight against the challenges of our times. And there is a giant roaring against us right now, like never before, that suggests to us that we just have to suck it up and swallow it down and keep on going as if nothing is hurting us. I'm talking a moment about black pain and how real it is and how true it is and how untreated it is and how ignored it is. When you start talking about mental health, we've got to attack it from every way possible, from therapy to clinicians to churches to every avenue of our society has got to stand up against this giant and begin to throw the kinds of rocks that bring it down. You cannot bring crime down until you deal with mental health. You cannot continue to shoot people who are actually sick and they need medicine. They need injections. They don't need to be shot down. But the reality is nobody is speaking up for those people today. And it is long overdue, my brothers and sisters, that we have some element of real change, pervasive change, gully-washing change, thirst-quenching change that rectifies the atrocities of our past. And the cry goes out, who will speak for us and who will go and work for us? But the answer comes back. My brothers and my sisters, we must move beyond or waiting on the next who and understand that it is not one of us, but it is, in fact, all of us. Not one of us can be derelict of our responsibilities and jump on social media and attack somebody else for not doing their part, because you must realize that we will not get there. Not to the place that Dr. King saw. We will not get there where black children and white children and brown children can join hands and sing free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty. I'm free at last. We will not get there. Not with one of us. But if it takes all of us, it can be done. I'm concerned about the giant of criminal justice and criminal justice reform. I'm concerned not only because of the tragic murder of George Floyd, forcing America to have to look at its inequities, the inequities that have gone unchecked in our criminal justice system, where criminal justice is executed on the sidewalk rather than the courtroom. But it is not just limited to this sidewalk vigilante type justice of which we are all falling prey to, where flashing lights intimidate us, where we wonder and take a second thought, is it safe to go jogging or not? Where we lay in our own beds and wonder, can we be safe in our own beds and in our own houses? Where black women are being targeted more readily, underrepresented, nobody fighting for them. It's time for change. What it didn't show is that in the back room of the courtrooms, there are plea bargainings that contribute to the incarceration of black and brown people in epic proportions. And though the numbers have gotten better, they're still not where they ought to be. And I, for one, will not rest until better turns to best. I will not rest until sons are returned back to their families and daughters are returned back to their mothers. I, for one, will not rest until I see our families come together and be able to unite without peering through bars in order to be connected together. This is a giant that we cannot afford. But the songwriter said, giants do come, but the bigger they come, the harder they fall. What does it take to bring down a giant? The question is of paramount importance in a time like this when America is so volatile and things are so crazy. What will it take to bring about the justice reform that we need? Do we just need the Congressional Black Caucus? We absolutely need them. Do we need the NAACP? We absolutely need them. Do we need the Action Network? We absolutely need them. But it will not be one of us. No. No, no. It will take all of us. The criminal justice system has so many tentacles, so much history. The reality is the war on crime turned out to be the war on us. The war on our sons. The war on our daughters. That's why we have got to breach this conversation and continue to talk about it, whether it is popular or not. I'm glad to see that there are some changes. I'm glad to see that there's some bipartisan support for some real change in the criminal justice reform. But I cannot wait on Washington to bring about a change. That's why I started our program, our Texas Offenders Reentry Initiative, because I cannot wait on Washington to save our sons, our daughters, our cousins, our brothers and our sisters. I'm happy to announce that 30,000 formerly incarcerated inmates have gone through our program that was designed to assist them with job opportunities, to get them ready for job readiness, to help them with anger management, to have their records expunged so that they have a fighting chance at a place to stay. If you get out of prison and you can't get a place to stay and nobody can hire you, there's no place to go but back in. In order to reduce the rate of recidivism, somebody has got to fight this giant so that once you get out, you can stay out. We do GED programs and overall life skills and all the things and whatever it takes to help them. But 30,000 is just a drop in the bucket compared to the thousands of men and women that are incarcerated behind prison walls right now. And in the middle of a pandemic, no less, where we who are free have retreated back into our homes, have covered our face with a mask. are questioning ourselves about whether to go to a restaurant or to a movie. Can you imagine what it would be like to be incarcerated where you have no options at all? And the giants are getting together and holding hands. The giant of health normalities and the giant of economic normalities and the giant of criminal justice are holding hands. Let's talk just a little bit about economic opportunities. Let's talk about the fact that the typical black household earns a fraction of white households, just 59 cents for every dollar. Let's talk about the fact that the gap between black and white annual household incomes is about $29,000 per year. That's not the income, that's the gap. Black Americans are over twice as likely to live in poverty as white Americans. This ought not just concern black people. This ought to concern all people. If we're going to be the beloved community, we cannot just get excited when the stats are referring to us. Black children are three times as likely to live in poverty as white children. How can you go to school and come out effectively when you're hungry? How can you go to school and learn and be at your best when you have not been fed for days at a time? How can you compete with kids and do homework while they are doing their homework? You are struggling trying to find something to eat. The median wealth of black families is $17,000, is less than one-tenth of that of white families in America of $171,000. It's a giant, but it's got to come down. The change will require all of us working together. Recently, we had the privilege to host the first black female, Dr. Yolanda Pierce, to hold position of the magnitude that she does for Howard University, dean over their School of Divinity. And while she was speaking for us, one of the questions that came in and asked her, what does social justice look like? And she told a story that stayed with us. She answered a question in a very unpredictable way. I thought she would talk about bullhorns and picket signs. I thought she would talk about social media and tweeting and texting, but instead she told us about when she was in college, having been raised by a bunch of church mothers. They came up to the college on the bus to check on her. And after having lunch with her as they were getting ready to depart, the old church mothers did like church mothers do and reached over inside of a little tavern that she had and pulled out a handkerchief with a roll of money in it and handed it to her and said, little girl, keep on going and keep on running. And as she began to talk about those old church mothers and that handkerchief, I could almost see my grandmother had one just like it, all rolled up with dollars and quarters and everything in it, and handed it to her. She said, that's what social justice looks like. Again, I want to remind you, it's not one of us. It's all of us. That is the beloved community. One person helping another. The beloved community is seeing somebody hungry and giving them something to eat. The beloved community is daring to care for people who are trying to pull themselves up and turn themselves around and fight the good fight of faith and endeavor to do something of significance with their lives. The beloved community answers the question, am I my brother's keeper? The beloved community understands that we are interconnected in such a way that we cannot afford to become isolated, nor can we allow the voices around us to intimidate us to the point that we lose the sense that we have an innate responsibility to care about not only what's going on in our world, but what's going on in the world. When elected officials and corporate leaders join forces with community activists and faith leaders, we can defeat the lingering giants that remain fighting us down to this present moment. Or as President Barack Obama so eloquently coined the phrase, together we can. And it is the unity of our community that the enemy fights the most. He does not want us to be connected. He would rather us be corrosive. He would rather us be accusatory. He would rather us be suspicious. He would rather us be intimidated. He would rather us self-destruct. But oh no, not this time. Not this time, because we understand it is not one of us. It is in fact all of us. The beloved community is illustrated best in the Bible by four healthy men who took on a task they didn't have to take on because one man was sick of palsy. They could have walked past him and left him, but they decided instead that they would lift the weight collectively of the one man. And so the Bible says that they hoisted the man up on their shoulders and began to carry him to the place where he could be healed. Our problem is not having enough unity. We are working in silos. We are not working together. But if we ever get together, if we ever join our forces together, if elected officials ever start talking to faith leaders and faith leaders start talking to CEOs and CEOs start talking to activists, together we could change this thing. If we ever began to understand that it's not one of us but all of us, we could change this thing. If we ever began to understand that it's not one of us, so we don't have to be crabs in a barrel, this one pulling that one down, this one tearing the other one down, fighting to be the one. I'm the man. No, you're the man. No, she's the one. No, she's the one. No, it's not one of us. Instead, my brothers and sisters, it is not one of us. It is all of us. When David got ready to kill the second giant, he thought he would run out there and do what he did before, only to find out that this time it was going to take something beyond him to get the job done. That the collective reasoning of all of those who had been influenced by him became the embodiment of his dream and his goal and his ideas. And suddenly he began to realize that he was more valuable coaching than he was fighting. That the strategy had changed from one boy with a bag full of rocks to a team of people collectively working together to bring about a change that we could not do by ourselves. If we try to kill the giant by ourselves, we will not survive because the strategy has changed. No, there will never be a Dr. Martin Luther King. That sound still rings in my head, the sound of that voice that arrested America, that stood the nation on its ear, that shook the apartheid in South Africa, that changed the circumstances in Selma, Alabama, that challenged Montgomery and fought off in Memphis, the voices that stood up against it. There will never be another Dr. Martin Luther King who filled Washington with thousands upon thousands, if not millions, of people of color back at a time that we had to ride the Greyhound bus and come up on trains to get together. There may not ever be another one like that one. But that's okay, because it is not one of us. It will take all of us. And so on this momentous occasion, as we celebrate and commemorate and memorialize and appreciate the significance of this particular individual, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who stood out from the rest, who blindsided America, who stomped his foot and the whole world shook, as we stand in pride and recognize that if there had not been a Dr. King, there would never be a T.D. Jakes. There would never be a Beyonce. There would never be an Oprah Winfrey. There would never be any of us whose names you might recognize if it had not been for that boy with that bag of rocks that stood up and dared to think that he could get it done. And do it without violence. He deserves our respect. He deserves our accolades. He deserves that we emulate the understanding that perpetuated an idea against the climate of the times with such power that he in fact did change the world. And I know you're not happy with where it is right now, but trust me, it's better than it was. And I know that we are not there yet, but we're further than we used to be. And like Paul, I count not myself to apprehend, but this one thing I do, I'm forgetting that which is behind and reaching to that which is before, understanding that I cannot reach without you, that it is not enough to reach up if I don't reach out, that it is not enough to reach up if I don't reach out. And so as I stand here behind this sacred desk, privileged with this divine assignment, I make myself your servant at your disposal, understanding that the servant who brought the lunch ended up the one who killed the giant. And we cannot lead until we learn how to serve. And we cannot go forward as long as we have a private agenda. And we cannot get there as long as we become trolls of each other's destiny, critiques and critics of each other, rather than understanding that in order to have a beloved community, we must have a common unity. We must focus on what unites us rather than fight about what divides us. And I want to assure you, because we have come through a tough season, and there is no doubt it has been a dark night, and it is a truth that we have stood in the rain too long, and we have been drenched by bad news. We have had to fight off a virus we couldn't even see. We've had to deal with the fires in California. We've had to deal with the floods in Alabama and Mississippi. We've had to deal with the coronavirus. We've had to withstand the loss of jobs and the loss of friends, and grandmamas and big mamas are all gone. But I want you to know that storms don't last always. And I want you to understand that trouble will not last always. And I want you to understand that injustice will not last always. And I want you to understand that racism will not last always. And I want you to understand that poverty will not last always. And sickness will not last always. There is a cure. There is a balm in Gilead. There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins. And sinners plunge beneath that flood and lose all their guilty stains. Can America lose its guilty stains? Yes, that stain can be purged out of our illustrious flag. It can be washed away. It can be taken down. It can be rearranged. But in order to scrub this stain out, it cannot be done by one of us. It is absolutely not one of us. My brothers and sisters, it will take all of us. So since we have survived the tumultuous winds of 2020, since we have survived the attack on our statistics and endured the hardships of the pandemic, and since we have survived the atrocities of the killings and unjust murders, and since we have survived what we have done to ourselves, inasmuch as we have survived against all odds, what will we do with another year? Will we just sit back and complain? Will we murmur one against another? Will we divide until the house is shattered? Or will we find the common thing that brings about the unity, that establishes the community, what Dr. Martin Luther King would call the beloved community? If we are to become the beloved community, it will not be because one person alone was committed. It will not be one of us. It in fact will be all of us. God bless you, and may heaven smile upon you. I need you, and you need me. And together, we become the beloved community.